the headlines, Iran and China say they will speed up the implementation of a landmark 25-year cooperation agreement aimed at strengthening economic and political ties. The UN says it lacks first-hand information about a deadly attack on a prisoner facility in eastern Ukraine as Russia and Ukraine accuse each other of targeting the camp. And Tunisia summons the U.S. Chargé d'Affaires over remarks by American officials criticizing this week's constitutional vote. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisoumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran's president tells his Chinese counterpart that Tehran supports the One China principle. Ibrahim Raisi says Tehran has always respected the territorial integrity of other countries as a key policy.
Respecting the national sovereignty and territorial integrity of countries is among the fundamental principles of the Islamic Republic of Iran's foreign policy. Within the same framework, backing the One China policy is the principled and definite policy of the Islamic Republic.
During the phone conversation, Raisi also condemned the United States for interference in the internal affairs of other countries. The president said Washington follows a destructive policy of unilateralism, which is now threatening global peace and security. China's Xi Jinping, for his part, says Iran has played a constructive role in maintaining regional stability. The two presidents also discussed ways to speed up the implementation of a landmark 25-year cooperation agreement between Beijing and Tehran. The deal is aimed at strengthening economic and political ties between the two countries. Iran's foreign ministry has warned about the threat posed by Israel's advanced military nuclear program and the failure of relevant international bodies to take necessary action. The ministry spokesman says the apartheid regime's relentless refusal to place its nuclear facilities under comprehensive safeguards poses a serious threat to international security. Nasser Kanani said that the UN nuclear agency should fulfill its responsibility in this regard as stipulated in its statute. He said that accordingly, the International Atomic Energy Agency and its Director General must strive towards promoting the peaceful applications of nuclear energy and non-diversion from those objectives. Israel is believed to have a stockpile of up to 400 nuclear warheads, but the regime maintains a policy of ambiguity in this regard. It refuses either to allow inspections of its military nuclear facilities or sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Palestinians are having no respite from Israeli atrocities as the regime forces kill yet another teenager in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry says a 16-year-old died of critical wounds sustained by live bullets in the chest. Another Palestinian was also shot and wounded by Israeli forces. The Palestinians were holding a demonstration near Ramallah against Israeli settlements when they came under attack by the regime forces and settlers. Israel has recently ramped up its violence against Palestinians, killing over 50 since late March. Nearly 700,000 Israeli settlers live in settlements in East Al-Quds and the West Bank. The settlements are built on land captured following the 1967 war and are illegal under international law. Earlier, we talked to our correspondent in the West Bank, Mona Kentel, for more information about the killing of the Palestinian teenager.
A 16-year-old Palestinian teenager, Amjad Abu Aliya, from the village of Al Mghayr near Ramallah, was shot dead by Israeli forces, by the fire of Israeli forces and Israeli settlers. This is according to eyewitnesses there. There was an invitation or a call for Palestinians to take part to take part in an anti-Israeli settlement protest, because Israeli settlers there, protected and backed by Israeli forces, continue to storm the Al Mughayyar village on a daily basis, attack Palestinians, throw stones at them, hit them in order to force them leave their lands, because the settlers want to confiscate more lands in the village of Al Mughayyar. So Palestinians were protesting there following the Friday prayers, and Israeli settlers raided again the village of Al Mughayyar, backed and supported by fully armed Israeli forces. And we have to mention that the Israeli settlers themselves are also armed like the Israeli soldiers. They opened fire at Palestinian protesters there, wounding dozens of them.
The International Committee of the Red Cross is seeking access to a prisoner facility in eastern Ukraine that was destroyed in what appeared to be a missile attack or explosion. The ICRC says it wants to help evacuate the dead and provide treatment to those wounded. It says personnel are in contact with prisoners' families. The facility is in the frontline town of Olekhinikawa, Donetsk province. It was hit on Friday. Pro-Russian forces in Donetsk say 53 Ukrainian prisoners of war were killed and dozens more wounded. Moscow says Kiev hit the prison with U.S.-made rockets to prevent Ukrainian soldiers from surrendering. Ukraine says Russia conducted the raid, put the blame on Kiev, calling it a UN and the Red Cross to investigate the incident. The UN says it lacks first-hand information about the attack. Tunisian Foreign Ministry has summoned the U.S. Chargé d'Affaires over remarks by American officials criticizing this week's constitutional vote in the African country. The ministry says it has denounced as unacceptable interference Tunisia's internal affairs. It said that remarks by the American official do not reflect the reality of the situation in Tunisia. The country on Monday held a referendum on a new constitution that grants almost unlimited power to the president. 30.5% of eligible voters took part. Nearly 95% said yes to the new constitution. Now, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has a voiced concern that the new constitution would weaken Tunisia's democracy. He said that it could erode respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms. Similar comments were echoed by ambassadorial nominee Joey Hood. China says it plans to hold military drills near Taiwan amid simmering tensions with the U.S. over the land. The Chinese government says the maneuvers will be held in the Taiwan Strait on Saturday and that any entry into the area will be prohibited. Live ammunition will also be fired during the exercises. The area has been a flashpoint of tensions between Beijing and Washington. China is opposed to the growing military and diplomatic ties between the U.S. and Taiwan. China also considers the island as part of its territory and has warned against what it calls U.S. provocations in the region. Earlier, we talked to political commentator Greg Simons to get some perspective on the U.S. stance on Taiwan. Russia has reiterated its backing of the One China policy. Simons said Washington's position on Taipei is similar to its strategy on the Ukraine conflict, which aims to contain Moscow.
Well, it's pretty clear. I mean, they're taking a very similar strategy and using it against China versus Taiwan, as they did between Russia and Ukraine before the war broke out. That this is meant to increase tensions and, I mean, this controlled chaos, which the US hopes to reassert itself as the leading global power, which at the moment is in disarray. What it's doing, it's very similar to what the United States was using between Russia and Ukraine. which was to constrain and contain Russia. And they're using a very, attempting a very similar strategy with China over Taiwan. However, this, of course, what we've seen, the response from Russia to the Ukrainian situation has actually undermined the US strategy. And they're repeating the same strategy again with China and Taiwan. The US, should we say, intellectually is not what it used to be. It's fighting a very short term and ultimately engaging in a losing strategy.
Moving on, a survey released by a British advocacy group, CAGE, has revealed shocking feedback regarding British schools pushing Western propaganda on Ukraine while engaging any student activism in support of Palestine. The findings appear to show the UK government involvement with both initiatives to peddle Ukraine's sympathy and outlaw Palestinian solidarity, Robert Carter reports.
A new study has revealed a shocking disparity by British schools, which have gone to great lengths to promote Ukraine solidarity among their students, in stark contrast to how Palestinian solidarity is suppressed in the classroom. Human rights group CAGE carried out the survey, which received 532 responses from parents, students, and teachers. The group said the survey revealed a cavalier attitude to due diligence, including collaboration with organisations with far-right links and the soft penetration of security think tanks and those linked to the UK's so-called Prevent Counter-Extremism programme. Some of the survey's findings include 96% of respondents confirming proactive engagement on the Ukraine issue by their school, including holding non-uniform days, activities, or donation appeals. 62% indicated their school had fundraised or hosted donation drives for Ukraine, while 17% also mentioned schools promote the Ukraine flag, such as hoisting the Ukrainian flag on school grounds. And perhaps most shockingly, alleged funding from some schools was intended to provide military gear for the war. In 2021, Israel's bombing of Gaza drew huge international backlash as millions took to the streets worldwide. British students also joined the outpouring of support for Palestine. However, British schools responded negatively, with students being punished for waving a Palestinian flag or branded racist in some cases for expressing solidarity.
For Palestine, supporting Palestine goes against British foreign policy interests. Support for Ukraine is in line with that, and hence that was allowed and encouraged, and the government even produced guidance for schools into how, and for parents into how they could do so. While for Palestine, the government minister for education at the time, Gavin Williamson, he issued a letter, clear letter to schools, indicating to them that discussion on Palestine needs to be clamped down or managed to such a degree where it can only ever amplify the pro-Israeli, pro-apartheid narrative.
In early July, London's High Court dismissed a legal challenge by CAGE against the Department for Education over issuing so-called discriminatory guidance, which was then used by schools to censor and penalise any student who was willing to express solidarity with Palestine, particularly during Israel's bombardment of Gaza last year. This whole saga will have convinced many more that Britain may indeed be biased when looking at conflicts and human rights abuses abroad. Robert Carter, London.
The U.S. political system has been dominated by two main parties, namely the Democrats and the Republicans. Even though there have been other parties, they have been unable to effectively challenge the two major parties so far. But now there appears to be a real push for a third party, a merger of three political groups.
As the political bickering continues to grow in the United States, calls are growing louder for a viable third party there. News has emerged that a group of former Democratic and Republican officials are now trying to form a third party in a bid to challenge the mainstream Republican and Democratic parties. The new party is called Forward. It's a centrist party and appeals to millions of voters who are dissatisfied with the two-party system. According to polls, two-thirds of U.S. citizens believe a third party is needed in the United States.
And the majority of people in this country are not Democrats or Republicans. They are independent. So if there were an opportunity to get on the ballot, I think there would be a lot of support for a third party.
The U.S. political scene has been polarized in recent years. There are now open threats of assassination against rival congressmen and women in the Capitol Hill.
Yeah, there's been a lot of, nasty partisanship. And we've seen that for the past 5-6 years, definitely. People have been at each other's throats. And we do have a situation in which people, I think the majority of people for the first time express they don't want, for example, either Biden or Trump to be president. You know, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with both parties. And there are strong, small factions in each party that are very determined to defeat the other side in a nasty way.
The new party will initially be co-chaired by former Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang and Christine Todd Whitman, the former Republican governor of New Jersey. The party plans to hold events across the U.S. this autumn. It will be officially launched in Houston on September 24. Forward will hold its first national convention next summer. The party is a merger of three political groups that have emerged in recent years. They include the New America Movement, the Forward Party, and the Serve America Movement. The party has described itself as a centrist political institution and is based on the platforms of reinvigorating the U.S. economy and giving Americans more choices in the elections. It aims to field candidates for local races, city council, state houses, the U.S. Congress, and all the way up to the presidency.
I think the worst problem in the United States as far as people's attitude towards the government is the tremendous distrust that people have towards both of the parties. Right now, we see the opinion polls for President Biden way down, but we also see that people don't have confidence in the Republican Party either.
Now that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Greetings to Muharram, greetings to Hussein. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As the Islamic month of Muharram arrives, mourning ceremonies and gatherings are held across the Islamic countries and other countries where Muslim communities live. Streets and alleys are adorned with black fabrics, which usually contain writings on Imam Hussein and his unmatched uprising. Glorious groups in orderly lines march on the streets while calling the sacred name of the Master of Martyrs and beating their chests. Children, men and women, old and young, take part in mourning ceremonies in black clothes. Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said, "Indeed, there is warmth for Hussein in the hearts of the faithful, which will never be cooled down. Greetings to Muharram, greetings to Hussein." Imam Reza, peace upon him, said on his father, Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, "When the month of Muharram arrived, no one would see my father smiling. Every day his grief would increase till the 10th day. That day would be his day of disaster, sorrow and crying." It has been also narrated that Imam Reza, peace upon him, told his companion, Rayyan ibn Shabib, "O son of Shabib, indeed Muharram is the month which the people would observe its respect during the era of Jahiliyyat. They would consider it forbidden to wrong or fight in this war. But this Ummah neither observed the respect of this month nor that of the Prophet. They killed his children, captivated his womenfolk, and looted their properties. O son of Shabib, if you want to cry for anything, cry for Hussein, son of Ali ibn Abi Talib." Then the Imam continued, "O son of Shabib, if you cry for Hussein so that your tears roll down on your cheeks, God will forgive every sin of yours, be it small or great. O son of Shabib, if you like to be settled in the houses of paradise with the messenger of God, damn the killers of Hussein. And whenever you recall him, say, I wish I were with them so that I would gain great success." A brief look at the practice of the Ahl al-Bayt, peace upon them, shows that they would observe the month of Muharram as the period of sorrow and mourning for the calamities of Imam Hussein, his companions, and his family. They would both weep for Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and urge their followers to do the same. They would ask the faithful to glorify the month of Muharram through holding mourning ceremonies. Crying for Imam Hussein revives religious signs. Imam Mahdi, may God expedite his reappearance, describes his grandfather, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, in Ziyara Nahiye Muqaddase as follows. "You are the son of the Prophet and explicator of the Quran. You are the helper and support of the Ummah and the struggler in the way of Allah's obedience, the guardian of the covenant, the destroyer of the ways of falsehood and hypocrisy. You are the one who was engaged in genuflection and prostration. You were so ascetic in the world like the one who is migrating from the world." Imam Hussein, peace upon him, never forgot God even for a single moment. As a matter of fact, the mystery of his eternity is that he was a true servant of God. whatever he did in his life was for God's sake and in the way of God. He would whisper, "In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, I seek help from Allah's name and Allah's truth, and in the way of Allah, and in obedience of the religion of Allah's messenger. And I have trusted in God, and there is no move or power except what God the Great wishes. O Allah, indeed I have put my soul under your care and turned my face toward you and ceded my affair to you." The month of Muharram is the time of Zila fervor. This month causes the hearts to join one another. All hearts turn toward Hussein and try to know him more and more. Everyone tries to take him as his role model. The faithful try to learn the lessons of Hussein and get as closer to him as they can. The personality of Hussein keeps shining throughout history, and it draws the seekers of freedom across the world. This peerless personality has caused formation of anti-colonialist and anti-oppression movements across the world. Today also, all movements which fight the global arrogance and Zionism owe their formation to Imam Hussein's uprising. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, didn't like to live a few years more under the rule of a libertine like Yazid. He taught dignity, freedom, and truth to human generations. He clearly showed that being Muslim does not comply with accepting humility. His followers, too, seek freedom and dignity through incessant struggle against the manifestations of oppression and arrogance, the US, the Israeli regime, and their lackeys and minions across the world.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Official figures show Eurozone inflation has soared to an all-time high, hitting a new record in July. This comes as the entire European Union is currently facing a hike in energy prices. EU statistics agency Eurostat says that Eurozone inflation has climbed to 8.9% in the month of July. That's while the fight against rising prices has raised fears of a recession. Meanwhile, Europe's largest economy, Germany, has experienced a period of stagnation this year, showing 0% growth in the second quarter of 2022. The global supply chain problems and the fallout of the Ukraine war are among the main contributors to the economic hardships across the Eurozone. Meanwhile, the entire EU has run into difficulties with its energy demands amid the face-off with Russia, which has resulted in a hike in gas prices. Joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have Professor of Economics at Metropolitan Autonomous University, Mr. David Barkin, who's joining us from Mexico City, and Independent International Affairs Analyst Gilbert Doctorow joining us from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Barkin in Mexico City. Why do the inflation numbers keep climbing and climbing in the Eurozone?
I think there are two reasons for that. One of them is the cost, the energy costs that are perhaps related to the conflict in the Ukraine and the cutting off or the reduction of the gas supplies. But the other is that some of the large international corporations are taking advantage of this by raising prices and increasing their profit rates in an extraordinary effort to really take advantage in a socially unacceptable way for of the present conjuncture. As a result, what we have is a combination of, yes, supply problems on the gas area, where Europe has been particularly vulnerable because it made a shift from other kinds of petroleum products to the gas. But the other, and I think that we can't underestimate the importance of the way in which profit rates are increasing at a tremendous rate at this particular moment in time.
Mr. Doctorow, in Brussels, are we looking at the threat of a full-blown recession in Europe? And many are wondering if the freefall continues, will the likes of the ECB, the European Central Bank, be put under pressure to act?
Well, yes, the inflation is not sustainable in the sense that it is against all of the economic rules that the central bank is obliged to enforce. Those rules are there because inflation as such is damaging to investment climate. It is politically risky because the population at large is immediately affected and becomes aware of the failure of government to protect their interests. However, inflation is only one side of the current crisis. The other side, which was suggested by my fellow panelist, is shortages. And perhaps the more dangerous threat to the economy is not inflation, but shortage. Shortage of energy, meaning the closing of industrial capacity and the idling of workers, which to a certain extent will be compensated by the governments, but otherwise will mean loss of income for swathes of the population. So the crisis that we're seeing now is only, in the remarks over 9% inflation rate, are only a foretaste of what is to come in a few months, if indeed the Russians hold their delivery of gas through Nord Stream 1 to 20%, or cut it entirely, which is not to be excluded.
David Barkin, Europe's largest economy, Germany, has experienced a period of stagnation this year. Statistics say that the German economy showed 0% growth in the second quarter of 2022. Is the trouble that the EU economic powerhouse Germany facing now also putting its mark on the record inflation across the Eurozone?
Well, obviously, as my colleague in Belgium has just emphasized, the problem of cutting off of gas supplies is tremendously important, but it has to do also not only with the Ukraine situation, but with a more generalized sanctions and the United States' efforts to punish Iran at this particular moment because of its alliances with Israel, further complicating the supply of the energy supplies within the European market. And furthermore, to what extent are the supply chain disruptions that are taking place are going to be allowed to affect the daily lives of the German people? I think that those are the principal questions, and those aren't questions that the European Central Bank can address, but rather they're questions that the geopolitical situation of the European Union is going to have to raise and may involve a confrontation with the United States.
Back to Brussels, Mr. Doctor, Europe has felt the full force of the aftermath of the sanctions on Russia. How much is Europe losing in all this in comparison to the United States, per se? The conflict is happening on European soil. It's been counterproductive for Europe to impose extreme sanctions on Russia as their economies are so closely linked. What is the cost of all of this for Europe as opposed to the United States?
Well, the United States is largely self-sufficient in energy and is an exporter in certain energy products. So Europe is incomparably weaker in its provision of energy from its own territories. It's far more dependent on imports. 40% of energy imports were coming from Russia, which as a result of the sanctions which and the planned cutbacks that Germany and other European nations said publicly in their breastfeeding and showing off how vigilant they were in protection of democracy and the reforms in Ukraine, Europe is paying a very heavy price for this posturing. The United States has been, as I say, spared the worst. However, the very fact that the United States came into the breach to supply its gas, its liquefied natural gas, to Europe and offer it as an alternative and a replacement for Russian supplies has had an impact on the American energy market, namely to greatly increase the domestic prices for gas. The country may be an exporter, but once it is exporting over certain limits, which is now the case, that affects the supply and availability and pricing of that very same energy to the American consumer. So the situation that is we see along all global energy markets comes back and bites the United States, not with the same severity, not with the same political risk as in Europe, But nonetheless, it's also felt there. Let's make plain that the energy crisis, which is now emerging in Europe, is not just an abstract consequence of a war between Russia and Ukraine, nor is it a consequence of Russia's weaponizing its gas deliveries. The political manipulation of energy supplies was initiated by Europe, by Germany in particular, by, as I say, their vocal statements against the continued use of Russian gas. And the Russians have stepped in and said, you don't want it, we won't deliver it. So let's get straight cause and effect. The cause was Europe's imposition of sanctions on Europe on Russian energy supplies. The effect is now beginning to be felt in the alarm across Europe, and Germany in particular, that they will not be able to fill their reserves to the 80% they hoped to reach gas reserves by November 1st, and that they will be dependent through the whole winter on good weather and on the good wishes of the Russians. At the same time, Germany has stood out as being eager to punish Russia. Mr. Scholz said just a week ago that even if Russia concludes a peace treaty with Ukraine, if that treaty enshrines Russia's gains at Ukraine's expense, then Germany will not do anything to lift the sanctions.
Sure.
In this context, it's clear that the Russians are responding in kind.
Okay. David Barkin, on that issue, on the topic that our guest in Brussels just brought up, the EU has run into a serious energy crisis as a result of the face-off with Russia. Do you think Europe chose the correct response to the Ukraine war?
There's a very complex geopolitical situation going on. And while my colleague in Brussels has correctly identified the political decision of the German government with regard to its negotiations or its relationships with Russia, I think that he left out the fact that the Iranian factor is also very, very important. And if energy supplies from alternative sources were mobilized, it would be possible to reduce some of the pressures within the European community. But that doesn't seem at this particular moment to be part of the equation. And so I would say that when you ask me, is it the correct response, I think it's a geopolitical question of how much extra European forces are going to influence what is happening within the European community.
Well, talking about that influence, Gilbert Doctorow, did Europe blindly follow the U.S. In its response to Russia and this conflict in Ukraine? Many would say America took the steering wheel and Europe just followed suit without really anticipating the damage of the sanctions on Russia. In terms of Europe, I think it's safe to say that they've already backfired.
Well, there are several factors here. Europe is 27 countries, and some are leaders in the vocal attacks on Russia and calling for stern sanctions, and some are followers. The major powers, France and Germany, are followers. The Baltic states and Poland are leaders in the call for very tough sanctions, which impact not so much them, but impact France, Germany, and the other European states. So we have to differentiate between the European countries here and their interests. That's the United States. Yes, of course, the United States has been a major determinant in European policies. But again, it is not so simple as it may seem. I think that a certain number of European countries were quite alarmed when they saw what Russia is doing and was and what it has changed in its policies as this war has gone on in the last several months. They have been alarmed at Russia's military capability, which some of them underestimated or didn't even want to think about. And they have become aware that European NATO members by themselves are totally unprepared for any military conflict with Russia. They have their defense only in the umbrella of the United States. And so if they have been more loyalist than the king, if they have been more stern and tough with Russia on energy, for example, than the United States has been, it is because they are simply scared of Russia, knowing their own military inferiority to the Russian forces. Let us note that before this military operation in Ukraine, Western mainstream media were all speaking of China and its military prowess, China and its vast investment in conventional and nuclear arms in the last year or two, in its programs of modernization, and China was all the talk. Now things have been restored to something resembling reality. The reality is that the second most powerful military force in the world is not China, it is Russia.
David Barkin, what kind of long-term effects are we looking at, not just for Europe, but for the global economy? If you recall, a while back, the World Bank and the U.S. Central Bank warned of the repercussions of the conflict in Ukraine. Bank of America and the Bank of England both increased interest rates, most likely to soften the impact of the conflict. Unpack that for us, please.
Well, I think that it's very, very important what you just said. The raising of interest rates is another one of the economic tools that the central banks have, but it has a direct effect on the costs, the cost of living, and the job availability of the people in the Western Europe, in the sphere of both of Europe and the United States. Raising interest rates will reduce investment. Raising interest rates will increase costs of living for a great many people in both the United States and in the monetarized credit part of Western Europe, or the whole Europe of the 27 countries. Rising interest rates are not going to be a solution for reinvigorating the capitalist economies. And so if you're correctly asking us to look at the wider implications of this, what you're seeing is also a mobilization of capitalist interests to take advantage of this in a rather unfortunate way. It will have a definite impact on reducing economic activity and the dynamics of economic activity in all of the countries we're talking about, but it will also have a direct effect on further tightening the economic screws against perhaps the middle classes in all of these countries.
Gilbert Doctorow, we've been talking about problems. Now let's talk about solutions. What are the solutions, in your opinion, in the short term and in the long run as well?
Well, the solutions in the short term will be the removal, the retirement of Scholz and several other leaders in the EU who are delusional, who are out of touch with reality, and who are leading their nations into the desert. The impact, the economic impact on Germany and on the neighboring countries, which depend on the German vitality of the economy, like Belgium, France as well. The economic condition of these countries is not yet experiencing the effect of the Russian cutoff of gas. That will hit in September and October. If this continues as it is now, Germany will experience a 6% recession. That will have a devastating effect on the whole European economy. So the near-term solution is to remove the incompetent, unprofessional, and ideologically biased leaders who are leading Europe into the desert. Mr. Johnson has gone, Mr. Draghi has gone, and it's about time that Mr. Schulz goes.
All right, and same question to Mr. Barkin before we wrap up the show. What are your thoughts on solutions?
I can't agree more with my colleague in Brussels on one air. There has to be a discussion within all of these countries about how to reset a government impetus to economic activity and social welfare in all of the countries involved. The events in the United States in the past few days, which say that Biden has successfully mobilized the political forces necessary for a new stimulus package that involves both energy, a reset of energy policies, as well as, and this is very, very important, a stimulus for some social welfare measures, is extraordinarily important. And I would agree and hope that what happens in the European common market, the European community, and in Great Britain also involves a re-examination of the impact of the way in which government policies up to now have limited economic activity.
All right, apologies. But I would also hope, Mr. Barkin, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to jump in there. We're running short of time. Allow me to thank my guests, Professor of Economics at Metropolitan Autonomous University, David Barkin, joining us from Mexico City, and also thanks to independent international affairs analyst Gilbert Doctorow joining us from Brussels, and a special thanks to you, our viewers, for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means to appoint.
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed.
His decree, though, we learn.
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah. So, dear listeners, we are talking about what happens to an individual who is affected negatively by their religious studies and its connection with our ubudiyah, our servitude, our worship, and our obedience to Allah. It is interesting, but we find a passage where Imam Khomeini, the founding father of the Islamic Republic and the initial and first leader of the Islamic Revolution, he writes in one place that it has been noted that among the students of religion sciences, there were some who had been badly affected by their religious studies. Now, what happens, dear friends, is that religious studies, whether you do them on your own or you go to a formal Islamic seminary, such as the Islamic seminary in Qom or the Islamic seminary in other parts of the world, whether you have this formal religious studies and formal religious training in the religious sciences, or whether you decide to do it on your own at a slower pace, at a much lower level, these religious sciences by themselves will give you a certain amount of information. Now, we must be very careful to differentiate between information and knowledge and wisdom. So these are three different things. The most basic is this information. It is data which you are receiving. Now, whether that is religious sciences or it's a-religious sciences, it is information, it is data which is being collected in your mind or in your heart. But the next level is knowledge. Knowledge is something which is different than just mere information. Knowledge is a level higher. And of course, a level higher than knowledge is wisdom. Now, these are all connected to each other in one form or the other. Now, when it comes to religious sciences and we are acquiring this information, we have to be very careful because sometimes this information can end up increasing our moral corruption, among other things, which we will talk about in the next segment. Now, how exactly this happens, it's not easy to say, but what we do understand is this information can be used for negative purposes, not just for your own self. You know, if you do not correctly understand what these religious sciences are saying. So if we talk about one example is a religious scholar who does not know the answer to a certain question, but makes it up on his own. That's something that's very dangerous and, of course, is something that not only hurts our ubudiyah and our servitude and our worship and our obedience to Allah, but it can very well also destroy our own selves. So we must be very careful when it comes to religious sciences, learning them, but learning them correctly and then being able to understand what it is that these religious sciences are teaching us.
The moon of Muharram, times of sadness have come, the crescent has now arrived.